Welcome to Tori Mecha Parsha. My name is Tzivi Zuckerman, and today we'll be learning Parshios Chukas and Balak. You know when you're reading a book and suddenly the story jumps ahead a few decades? That's exactly what happens in Parshios Chukas. We suddenly find ourselves in the Jewish people's 40th year in the desert. Over those 40 years, the generation that left Egypt had slowly passed away as atonement for the sin of the spies. The Parsha begins with the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, the red heifer, whose ashes were used to purify people from tumas meis, spiritual impurity from contact with a corpse. What's interesting is that this mitzvah was actually taught to Moshe at an earlier time in the desert. So why is it placed here in Parshas Chukas? We've discussed before that the sin of the spies, which led to the death of the Exodus generation, was really an extension and expression of the sin of the golden calf that occurred shortly after the giving of the Torah. At Har Sinai, the Jewish people experienced an extraordinary level of clarity. They experienced themselves as souls attached to Hashem. And had they maintained that level, they would have lived eternally. But the sin of the golden calf reintroduced death into the world. The Medrash explains that the mitzvah of Parah Aduma, which is the mother cow, purifies people from the impurity associated with death, and it comes to atone for its child, so to speak, the calf in the sin of the golden calf, which brought death back into the world. So the Parah Aduma purifies us from the tumah related to death. Now, death is considered the avi avos hatumah, the primary source of spiritual impurity. But what is it about death that causes tumah? Rav Moshe Shapiro explains that before we can understand tumah, we first need to understand tahara, spiritual purity. Tahara indicates a clarity of vision. It means seeing reality without obstruction and maintaining a clear connection to the source of life. Tumah, by contrast, is concealment. It's a blockage that prevents us from seeing reality as it truly is. We know that when a person dies, his body is cut off from his soul. But if we're honest, most of us don't have much of a sense of what the soul is. If someone asked you, "Do you have a soul?" you'd probably answer, "Of course." But there's a more accurate way to think about it. You don't have a soul. You are a soul. It's like asking someone, "Do you have a person?" They'd say, "Have a person? I am a person." So our soul is the essence of who we are. It existed before we're born. It'll continue to exist after we die. But most of us don't think of or experience our soul as the center of who we are. In fact, it's often difficult to even picture what that means. Rabbi Ari Kaplan offers a fascinating thought experiment in his book, If You Were God. Imagine that science discovers how to transplant a human brain. Let's say, God forbid, a close friend is very ill, and her brain is transplanted into a new, healthy body. After the surgery, which person would you visit? The body you recognize, or the new body that now contains her brain? Instinctively, you know that your friend is the one with the brain, because that's where her memories, personality, and inner life reside. The brain is the seat of the soul. And that intangible inner consciousness, that awareness that makes you you, that's your soul. In this world, we exist as a partnership between two elements, our temporary, physical, limited body, and our eternal soul, which is our true self. Our true self, our soul, lives on forever. But when the soul departs and the body becomes lifeless, it creates the impression that life ends with death. It reinforces the illusion that the world is a purely physical place, existing independently of Hashem and devoid of deeper purpose. This loss of clarity obscures the truth. It blocks our ability to see reality as it really is. And that concealment is what creates tumah. We'll see that the concepts of tumah and tahara, and the degree to which the Jewish people can see reality with clarity, without obstruction, are themes that continue to appear in Parshios Chukas and Balak. As we'll see, these ideas are not just philosophical concepts. They frame the major events in Chukas and Balak. And they become especially relevant now because the Jewish people have reached a pivotal moment in their journey. Now that they've atoned for the fundamental sins of the golden calf and the spies, they're finally poised to enter Eretz Yisrael. We've quoted the Nitziv's idea before, that Sefer Bamidbar serves as a bridge between two very different worlds. It's a transition from the openly miraculous life in the desert to the more natural-looking reality of life in the land of Israel, where Hashem's guidance would often be hidden behind the veil of nature. This shift began now, during this 40th year in the desert. At this point, the previous generation had passed away, and a new generation now stood ready to enter the land. But the question is, how would they enter the land? Would they enter with a clear awareness that Hashem is the source of everything, even in the framework of nature? Or would recognizing Hashem within the natural world remain an ongoing struggle? The turning point and testing grounds was the episode of Mei Meriva. When Miriam died, the miraculous rock which had supplied water in her merit ceased to flow, and the people immediately complained about the lack of water. Hashem told Moshe to take his staff, gather the people, and speak to the rock so that it would provide water. By this point, Moshe generally no longer used his staff. His staff had been the instrument with which he performed all the miracles of Egypt and the Exodus, and it represented the supernatural reality that defined life in the desert. But why did it matter whether Moshe spoke to the rock or struck it? Why did Hashem specifically command him to speak to it? Rav Moshe Shapiro explains that hitting something represents coercion. It means forcing someone or something to produce what it would not naturally produce on its own. Speech represents the opposite. Speech emerges from within. A person speaks because they want to reveal who they are, what they think and feel, and to make their inner reality visible. Think about a DMC with a friend. You're sharing because you want to be known to each other, and each person is voluntarily revealing who they are because they want to connect. So hitting is coercive, and speaking is non-coercive, voluntarily revealing. The way Moshe brought forth water at this critical crossroads would shape how the natural world would appear to us going forward. Had Moshe spoken to the rock, nature itself would have openly revealed Hashem's presence. The spiritual purpose embedded within every object, event, and phenomenon in the world would be readily apparent. But Moshe hit the rock. And because the action implied coercion, the world that emerged reflected that reality. We live in a world that conceals its deeper spiritual dimension. We need to expend great effort to actively draw out nature's hidden message and reveal Hashem's presence and direction behind everything. Had Moshe spoken to the rock, history would have unfolded differently. He would have led the Jewish people into Eretz Yisrael and built the Beis HaMikdash. It would have stood forever because all of nature would naturally express the goals of Torah. And it would have been obvious that nature is not an independent force. It's simply the expression of Hashem's will. Moshe, however, belonged to the world of the desert. He operated within a supernatural reality in which miracles compelled creation to reveal Hashem's presence. As a result, he couldn't lead the people into the next stage of history. The nation now faced a longer journey of learning to develop emunah. Emunah is a deep, visceral awareness of Hashem's presence that shapes the way we see and respond to everything around us. And emunah develops specifically within the natural world, where Hashem's presence is hidden. It emerges through the journey itself, through mistakes, through struggle, and through the lessons we learn from the consequences of those mistakes. We can see this principle even in ordinary life. My husband's uncle Larry failed a class in Brooklyn College, this was many years ago, and he was by his own admission undisciplined. But this was during the Korean War, and his draft deferment depended on passing this class. He begged his professor to pass him, but the professor refused. Uncle Larry was very unhappily drafted to the Marines, and he said that it was the best thing that happened to him in his life. He gained a work ethic, he became disciplined and successful. He totally changed as a person. In a certain sense, the Jewish people are about to undergo a similar process. The remainder of Parshas Chukas traces the process of the Jewish people changing through a series of challenges, many of them far more natural than the miraculous experiences they had become accustomed to in the desert. Some end in failure, But collectively, they begin to transform the people and lead them toward deeper emunah. First, Edom refuses to grant the Jewish people peaceful passage through its territory. Some of the people attempt to negotiate further with Edom without Moshe's approval. Rashi explains that this represented an excessive friendliness toward Edom, and as a consequence, Aaron passed away. And with his death, the clouds of glory, which had existed in his merit, also disappeared. Suddenly, the people found themselves exposed. Amalek attacked. Many people fled in terror, but the tribe of Levi blocked the retreat, which led to much loss of life. But then the people recognized that they had failed to eulogize Aaron properly, and they corrected their mistake. They davened intensely for success, and then they launched a counterattack against Amalek, which proved highly successful. But the lessons weren't over yet. As the people continued their long detour around the land of Edom, they once again complained, this time about the journey itself and about the Mun. Hashem withdrew his protection, and poisonous snakes attacked the camp. Hashem instructed Moshe to make a copper snake and place it on a tall pole. Anyone who looked upward and directed their thoughts toward Hashem would be healed. The snake itself possessed no power. The healing came when people lifted their eyes beyond the immediate problem and recognized that Hashem alone was the source of salvation. After these experiences, something changed. The nation began placing its trust fully in Hashem. And that transformation becomes evident in the events that follow. The next several episodes unfold very differently from the earlier ones. The miracles are no longer open and obvious. Hashem's intervention is still there, but now it's hidden beneath the surface of natural events, more natural events. As the Jewish people traveled through the Arnon Valley, they discovered evidence of a remarkable salvation. Water flowing through the valley carried the blood and remains of an Amori army that had been lying in ambush, intending to attack them. The people hadn't even known they were in danger, but Hashem had protected them. The people's response was to break out in song. They sang the Shiras Haba'er, expressing gratitude and recognizing Hashem's loving care, even when his involvement wasn't immediately visible and so obvious. That shift in perspective is significant. The nation was beginning to learn how to see Hashem's presence, even when it wasn't accompanied by dramatic miracles. And the same pattern continues in the battles that follow. The Jewish people confronted Sihon, the king of Amori, and Og, the king of Bashan, and both were very formidable opponents. But the Jewish people were victorious, and these victories didn't come through huge open miracles for the most part. They came through what appeared to be ordinary military campaigns, but the people understood that the victories weren't really theirs. They davened Hashem, they placed their trust in him, and they recognized that success ultimately comes from him alone. From there, they traveled to the plains of Moab on the eastern side of the Jordan River, opposite Jericho, which was the place from which they would eventually enter the land of Israel. And that brings us directly into Parshas Balak. Balak, the king of Moab, was terrified by everything he had heard about the Jewish people's victories over Sihon and Og. He understood that conventional warfare was unlikely to succeed. So instead, he turned to a different strategy. He hired Bilam. Bilam was famous throughout the ancient world as a powerful sorcerer and prophet, and Balak hoped that Bilam's curses would succeed where armies had failed. At the beginning of Parshas Chukas, we discussed the concepts of Tumah and Tahara. Tahara is spiritual clarity, which allows a person to access the highest possibilities of what it means to be human. It enables our seichel, our higher spiritual intellect, to guide all of our physical abilities and drives, desires, toward meaning, purpose, and connection to Hashem. Bilam represented the exact opposite of this. He was a person completely controlled by his physical drives. Throughout the narrative, we see him constantly pursuing honor, wealth, status, and self-gratification. Every decision is filtered through his own desires. The Tzor Hamor explains that Bilam epitomized a person who abandoned his soul in favor of fleeting physical urges. Even the language the Torah uses when Hashem appears to Bilam hints to this reality. The Torah says, V'yikar Elokim al Bilam. Hashem happened to appear to Bilam, but the term is associated with a form of tuma connected to immoral thoughts. When Bilam's attempts to curse the Jewish people failed because Hashem transformed his curses into blessings, he proposed a different plan. If the Jewish people couldn't be defeated from the outside, perhaps they could be corrupted from within. He advised Balak to send the women of Moab and Midian to entice the Jewish people to sin. Bilam, who was consumed with his own lowly and selfish desires, knew that Hashem hates immorality. Rav Hirsch explains that the deity involved in this episode, Baal Pa'ar, is the god of shamelessness. Shame exists when we recognize our own value and then fail to live up to it. If human beings possess no higher purpose, no spiritual dignity, and no moral responsibility, then shame makes no sense. There's no shame where there's no value. Baal Pa'ar celebrated precisely that worldview. It's worship centered around behavior deliberately designed to strip human beings of dignity and reduce them to creatures driven solely by instinct. They have no divine nobility and no dignity and certainly no ability to choose differently and to elevate themselves into more lofty spiritual beings with an association with the divine. This stands in absolute opposition to the idea of Tara. Tara proclaims that we are more than our impulses. We possess genuine moral freedom. We can choose. We can grow. We can elevate ourselves. Even when we stumble, we're not defined by those failures. We are souls created in the image of Hashem, capable of becoming something greater than we are today. And that brings us back to our earlier themes. We began with Para Aduma and the concept of Tara, the clarity that connects us to our soul and to our source. We then followed the Jewish people through the transition from a supernatural existence to a more natural one. At Mei Meriva, the course of history was set. The world would no longer openly reveal Hashem's presence. Nature would act as a veil, and uncovering the spiritual reality beneath it would require effort. In other words, Tara would not come automatically. It would require work. Bilam represents the opposite path. He embodies a life focused entirely on physical desire, a life in which the animal side of the human being takes control. And in many ways, our world often feels more like Bilam's world than Moshe's. We live in a culture that encourages us to chase every impulse, satisfy every desire, and view the visible external layer of reality as the only thing that matters. But deep down, we sense that there's more. We sense that beneath the surface lies a deeper reality. We sense that we're more than bodies, more than instincts, more than the immediate concerns that occupy our attention. Developing the ability to perceive that deeper reality takes effort. It requires sensitivity and spiritual attunement. But that effort is not merely a means to an end. The process itself shapes us. Every time we choose to look beyond the surface, every time we seek meaning instead of settling for appearances, every time we strengthen our awareness of Hashem's presence, we're creating ourselves. And what could be more meaningful than that? Thank you for learning together.